KBOO on your radio, just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/kboo.
You can find all this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2, KBOO's special programming campaign. Check out all the special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
I'm Tony Epstein, and this is the Magical Mystery Tour. Join us as we dive into the heart of things, exploring new ideas and new ways of seeing and being in this wondrous, crazy world we share together.
This is a journey into sound.
Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems in the form of energy, all our sensory systems, and then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like. It explodes into this
technicolor dream.
About your world.
Stay tuned.
My guest is Langston Kahn. He's a shamanic practitioner specializing in emotional clearing and radical transformation, and he's the author of Deep Liberation, Shamanic Tools for Reclaiming Wholeness in a Culture of Trauma, which offers practices to help us navigate and transmute the great challenges and insanity of our time into the medicine for personal, communal, and world healing. So, welcome to the Magical Mystery Tour.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So in the book, you write that you were a very sensitive kid growing up, and I was also a very sensitive and also deeply traumatized kid. And for me, it took many, many years of intense inner work and at the same time learning to navigate the world as someone who never really felt like I quite fit in to eventually, you know, turn some of that poison into medicine, which is a metaphor that I love. And so I just loved this book, and I related so much with your story and this work of deep liberation.
Thank you. Yeah, I was a very sensitive kid, and I think that was compounded by a transition that my family made when I was about 6 years old, where we moved from like a really richly diverse and interesting neighborhood in Washington Heights to a predominantly white neighborhood where I was sort of like the one black kid in the school I was going to for a long time. And so I think my natural proclivity towards sensitivity combined with that sort of shock of this sudden racialization of my experience that I didn't really have context for definitely sent me very inward into myself, and it took a long time to sort of repair those bridges that would allow me to come back into the present moment really and feel like I had full access to my emotional capacity and my sort of ability just to be in the present and make choices from that place versus feeling sort of trapped inwardly within myself.
So how did you end up coming to this healing work, and what did it take for you to make that inner transition?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, it's funny when you ask the question, how did you come to the healing work? It's like, when did I come to the healing work? It all sort of melds together in that I was always a person who, partly because of that sensitivity we're speaking about, was very aware of the pain and emotions of others. You know, partly because of some, you know, biographical trauma in my environment, I was very hypervigilant to others' feelings and emotions. And so when there was someone who was in pain or upset or being isolated or sort of bullied or exiled by other kids, I always felt like I needed to be the one to go help them. Probably because I felt pretty isolated and exiled myself on some level inside, even though it was easier for me to sort of adapt and adjust than most. So as I grew older, the people who I was drawn to be friends with were often the kids who were also more sensitive and often more creative and more expressive in different ways and weirder. And what I came to realize is those kids who were so bright in so many ways, like not just, I don't just mean brightness in terms of intelligence, but just so radiant in the truth of who they were and their own uniqueness, also tended to be the kids who were struggling with a lot of serious mental health issues in terms of depression or bipolar disorder or self-harm or other ways of experiencing pretty intense suffering. And what I came to see during that time, this is really in middle school and high school a lot, was that the adults didn't really seem to have the answers to these issues that I was experiencing and my friends were experiencing. That the only answer, and this was like one of the better answers, was therapy. And even then, mostly the therapists seemed to go pretty quickly to prescribing medication. There's nothing wrong with medication, but there wasn't a really giving these kids tools to go deeply inward and see what was the root of the symptoms they were experiencing as this intense pain and alienation and disconnect versus just trying to manage the symptoms. And if that didn't quite work, just thinking, oh, we just need another medication. And on top of that, the parents, you know, obviously need to be in a lot of pain too, and were managing their own challenge and issues and not always able to be an adult in the way that allows kids to just be kids. So that really stuck with me as a question in my heart of why is this the case? And I got a little bit of a political framework too in middle school, because there was this wonderful teacher, Mr. Cohen, who would meet with us at like 6 a.m. in the morning before school started and read countercultural books like from the 60s, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with us. And that gave me this framework to start to see these challenges my friends were facing as not just solely about a personal issue, but to see this larger system that seemed to be, you know, crushing my friends in its effort to make them conform to a certain ethos of productivity at all costs, productivity at the expense of the soul, even at the high school level. And so those questions of why is this the case? Why is no one talking about this larger system or in a way that seems like it has traction and can actually help to create change stuck with me. And I graduated from college, I ended up going to film school actually, and I graduated from college, you know, it was the height of the recession. I had a ton of mental health issues of my own I was dealing with, and also chronic health issues of autoimmune disorders. And I was in the hospital like 4 times a year. And I was really struggling to get a job. And so I decided, okay, it's time to actually commit to my spiritual practice in a different way, because I'm sick of these issues. I was, at the time, when I did have jobs, I was working a lot on film sets, which were like, you know, 72-hour days a lot of the times, and just, you know, not great food and not great emotional environments necessarily. And I just realized I needed to reorient myself from trying to live my passion in the world as a filmmaker to actually focusing on my mental and emotional health and well-being and getting a job that was more stable. And so I just started working at this really simple data entry job. And that gave me time to start exploring a lot of different spiritual perspectives, a lot of them through podcasts, actually. It was kind of like the peak, that initial peak of the podcast scene just becoming a sort of mainstream thing about like 10 years ago or so. And what happened was I began to start to find my way to traditions where I'd find snatches of answers to the questions I had about why the world was the way it was. And the place where I really started to find big answers was actually shamanism, particularly one podcast by, you know, one of my primary teachers today, Christina Pratt, of Why Shamanism Now, where she was talking about how part of the reason she saw as the root cause of a lot of the dysfunction in our current cultural landscape was because of this abandonment of ritual, and specifically the abandonment of the ritual tending of these thresholds of birth, initiation into adulthood, eldership, and death. So there is no longer this sense of children just being born, having elders tending their purpose, divining with the mothers what they were coming here to do, and then making sure they had the support that they needed to do that thing, and then have a name that would remind them of that thing when they reached the age where it was time for them to start to feel into that energy who they are. And there was no longer true adults and elders that could come together and take teens out when they just first started becoming teens. So adolescence wasn't this long, protracted thing, and they could be supported in dropping their family of origin baggage and reminded of the essence of their purpose they came here to live, and reconnected to a lineage and a visceral relationship with their ancestors, so where there was this greater sense of belonging that transcended just their parents and immediate family, so then they could return to their village as true adults that could bring their gifts in service to their community, and their community would continue to tend and serve their ability to move into and grow their gifts so they could live a life of heart and meaning. and then eventually become elders who had true wisdom to share with younger people, and eventually die in a good way, knowing they had really done what they came here to do, and that death being tended in a good way so they could become ancestors, and every generation wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel, because that wisdom that had been collected over the course of a human life would be being transmitted again to the next generations through that living relationship with the ancestors. And so as I began to feel into these concepts, I started to see deep patterns of dysfunction in my own life, and I eventually pursued a shamanic healing after I had a kind of deep initiatory experience where I've been practicing with a spiritual and magical group for about 3 years, and it was the first time in my life where I was really, you know, meeting every full moon to do work, to magical work together, and we were training in our sort of psychic and magical skills, and it was a really strict ritual setting. And I think that structure, because I'm a double Pisces, so I'm very, you know, watery and unstructured sometimes, and that intense ritual tradition and structure that I was part of at that time, I think opened me up and helped my helping spirits to see, wait, he's ready now. And at the time, I was also doing a lot of inner emotional work with a process called inner relationship focusing that was sort of starting to just begin to help me to mend the gap between my ability to fully express my emotions, and or at least just first to feel them, to really feel them and not feel so disconnected and dissociated from my body. And the combination of those two things, intense ritual practice and this deep inner work that I was just starting on, I think resulted in my helping spirits deciding to sort of shake up my life a bit. And I had this really intense dream where this animal helping spirit landed on my chest. And every time it landed there, there were these sort of like parasites or biting things or ticks that would fall off of it and be like wounding me in some way. And so at the time, my teacher in the dream was in bed with me in a forest. And I turned to her and asked her, can I tell this to go away? And she's like, yes, but ask for its name first. And so I did. It gave me its name. And then I woke up thinking, okay, what do I need to do to help my helping spirit? My helping spirit is covered in parasites. And when I actually journeyed with the help of the spiritual group I was working with at the time to that spirit, they just laughed in my face. They're kind of a trickstery spirit a bit. And they said, you idiot, like I'm showing you what's wrong with you. I don't need help. Like you're the one that needs help. You're covered in these sort of energetic parasites. And so that led me to book my first shamanic healing session to deal with that issue. And the first person I went to just said, this is just your stuff. It's not like some, you know, big entity that's affecting you or some, you know, horrible ancestral curse. It's just your stuff that's getting in the way and at the root of a lot of the chronic health issues you're having too. And so it's like, okay. And they were like, do you want me to rip it out? And I said, okay, because I didn't really know what I was doing at that point. And so they did. They just ripped it out. And my symptoms dramatically improved for 2 weeks and then came back much, much worse. And so I knew like there was something to what was happening, but I needed more help. And so I eventually found my way to another practitioner. And that practitioner was able to describe for me not just that it was my stuff, but when and where in my life each layer of these patterns had formed. And she's able to see the same thing the other shaman had seen without me even telling her about it, but describe in detail sort of the emotional and psychodynamic aspects of the pattern that was quote unquote my stuff and how it related to my sort of spirit as well. So both that intersection between the physical body, the emotional body, the spiritual body, and the mental body all coming together in a very articulated, clear, detailed way. And so I knew I wanted to continue working with this person and study with them. And at the time it was 2011. So I was like, wow, the world might end, you know, next year. And so I decided to invest in this 5-year training program. I'm not even sure if I realized the time that it was 5 years right away, in becoming a spiritual adult. That felt like an answer to the questions of that question I had in my heart of why is there so much pain and suffering and no adults that are able to help kids who are feeling that way. And over the course of those 5 years, more and more I began to realize that it was actually a really helpful vehicle for me to begin affecting healing for other people as well. And I was eventually asked to teach the teachings as one of the first people in 30 years that had been asked to teach those teachings of that 5-year training program as well. And so I just began more and more to listen to my helping spirits and work with my helping spirits that I had forged an intimate relationship with on behalf of others. And the first work I was doing was just deep inner energetic and emotional work of the deep liberation process with people that really felt like part of my unique genius. Because I had had to struggle so much with my own gap between my ability to feel my emotions and express them in real time versus like weeks later versus when I felt totally overwhelmed and was having all sorts of physical symptoms, to really be able to just be in the dance of my emotions in real time and allow them to move my heart and then action had been really hard won for me over those years of training. And so I had a gift for helping people who were struggling with that relationship with their inner life and their emotions and their body to move into a place of intimacy and relationship with their inner experience that was very visceral and tangible. And so that's in essence what led me to be a healer, because unlike when I was younger and all I could do is really listen to people that were in pain and try to be there for them, I suddenly had tools that I felt were able to work much more directly at the root, because I had walked a lot of the path of my own healing, and that's obviously a path I'm still on. I felt I had a place I could lead others down that was territory I understood. And that just felt really nourishing for me to be able to assist people with what had been such a poison in my life when I first picked it up and when I first experienced it, to now be able to help other people in a similar situation.
That's such a wonderful, wonderful story. And it heartens me so much to hear that you found something so comprehensive and valuable in your life so early. Back when I was going through my desperation, you know, to heal myself, it was much more of an experimental process. Because the people that I was encountering who were also suffering and desperately seeking answers, we were finding various answers and we were experimenting with them, but we didn't have a comprehensive way of really fully integrating them and making sense of our lives out of it. So, But one thing that we did have was this empathy for other people who were suffering and also desperate to find ways to heal and find our place in the world and make sense of all the kind of inner and outer chaos that we were trying to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the oversimplification of my story, I don't want to make it seem like it was too linear. I definitely was very experimental at well. There was years, even when I was in that really strict tradition, there were years that I was just going to any ritual I could go to, any random class or workshop I could go to, and just experimenting with anything I could find. But I think what helped me to, I've been really blessed with teachers who were deeply authentic and of integrity. And I think what helped me guide me on that journey towards that, you know, searching for that clear, pure source of true eldership that is flowing in the world more, I think, now than perhaps in other times recently, there was this learning. The more that I began to really understand the logic of my inner space, and not just my inner space, but all inner spaces, this understanding that's really a core part of the way I work now, that the more we can bring our compassionate curiosity to whatever we encounter inside of us, the more it will open and expand and shift and grow and transform and point us towards forward movement. That principle gave me this sense of truth that I could then take to any system I was exploring and studying and see at its essence, does this system respect this truth that, you know, everything inside of us deserves, in a sense, a friendly hearing, that even the wounds we carry, would it know they were wounds unless they also knew what it felt like to be whole and healthy? And does the system respect that truth and that principle that I find is what allows my own inner experience to open up to me. And that was hugely helpful in sort of sorting out what was maybe more, you know, bullshit, to put it politely, really, versus actually teachings with a deep root that really were in service of liberation, was really helpful for me, because there is so much out there and so much that's really built on very shaky foundations.
Yeah, so it sounds like you connected with the essence of this whole process and what your actual inner journey was and what these different healing and spiritual practices and traditions were pointing at, were actually offering. And I love the way you related that to recognition of the wound, that you have to have some connection with the part of you that isn't wounded to be able to recognize the wound. Otherwise, we live in a kind of ubiquitous state of just being wounded, kind of like fish in water.
Yes, and I guess another way I'd put that is that the part of us that isn't wounded is the part that's wounded. And that sounds very gnomic and, you know, like gobbledygook. But what I mean when I say that is a very simple truth, that like, just like we don't know when we're tired, we wouldn't know what tired was unless we knew also what it felt like when we were vital and healthy and energized. It's the same way with any wound inside of us. It wouldn't know that something was off, that something was wrong, that something felt fragmented or in pain, if it didn't also know what it felt like to be whole and to be in the flow of the living process that we are. So it's not just that there's like the wounded parts and the parts that feel really deeply healthy and well, but more that it's all the same. Like the wounded parts are also the parts of us who are trying to remind us what it might feel like to be at a different level of health and well-being. And that's where their pain is coming from, being in that gap. And so I think what we describe as feeling wounded is often the feeling of being in a relationship of struggle with our wounds, where we're exiling them or trying to push them down or control them, or in a relationship of identification with our wounding, where our wounds are sort of hijacking us, or the parts of us that have been cut off from the living process that we are and have become fragmented or dissociated a bit, we unconsciously identify with them. And then we're seeing life through the lens of this one small part of us versus through the fullness of who we are. And that's very painful. And so when we can be in the fullness of who we are and step into relationship with these fragmented selves, that then allows us to give them the space and witnessing and the compassion and curiosity for them to actually share with us a vision of greater health and well-being, and that we can move towards together. Whereas when we're exiling our wounds, or when we're identified with our wounds, there's not a possibility of deep relationship there that can create change and transformation.
Right. The medicine is embedded within the trauma, within the poison itself. They're inextricably related. And if we're either overly identifying with it or pushing it away, we're going to miss that. It sort of reminds me of a dream I had last night. I had a wild, wild night of dreams last night. But there was one interesting, very short segment where I was at this huge sort of event/party, and I walked into this room that was sort of like a maze in a way, in that when I walked into it, all of a sudden I realized that I was trapped in this room, and I was looking around the room and the walls were totally sealed. There was no way out, and it was moving and I was in the middle of it. But then I noticed when I looked in the other direction, I could barely see out of the corner of my eye that there was an opening. And so then I realized all I had to do was actually turn and move in the opposite direction, and there was the way I came in, which I was able to then walk out. But as long as I was looking in this other direction, the direction that the room seemed to be moving in, that I was kind of mesmerized by, I felt completely trapped.
Wow, that's a powerful dream. I love that. And so valuable too, that these like visceral experiences that our body gives us, you know, in our dream life, that's not just about like something on an intellectual level, like an idea or concept. Like when you say it in words, it can sound very simple, but so precious to have that visceral feeling in your body of what it might be like to when you feel that sense of being sealed in this room, to try to turn to see another perspective or to move in a different direction than you're currently moving.
And I also consider myself to be extremely fortunate in that I was very, very blessed to have these powerful revelatory experiences with every new thing that I encountered. So I would get a taste, a really solid taste of the essence of what was at the core of it. So that even though I was living in the midst of a chaotic and very messy and screwed up sense of self, I had touched that place that was inside myself, and yet it was also available everywhere and that I shared with everybody else. So even though I went through a very long, long, grueling process of suffering and trying to navigate, you know, that whole dynamic, I always carried that deep essential experience. And so even in the deepest darkness and sense of despair and confusion and chaos, there was always this, even just the tiniest seed of knowing that there was something else. There was something at the core of it that I couldn't really completely lose, no matter how far into despair I fell. And over and over and over again, I fell into great despair and depression, and I saw people around me experiencing the same thing, and yet we all still had this deep essential recognition inside, like a seed, and sometimes we had it as a full-blown experience, but often it got overwhelmed and eclipsed by the raging chaos and confusion of our lives and the world around us.
Yes, absolutely. I really appreciate you sharing that. I think that's so important that we, you know, hold those experiences of our essence, not as these like peak experiences that we have to keep like struggling to get back to through, you know, different types of ritual or plant hallucinogens or whatever it is that we're using to get back to that peak state of experience, but rather instead as a truth we've now experienced that we can hold and change our life and our actions to orient towards that truth being true, now that we've felt it viscerally in our body, that truth of our essence. And so, okay, so if that's the truth of who I am, how do I need to change how I'm walking through the world? I think you really beautifully described that experience. And I think we're in a time where those types of experiences and even like a level of safety to be able to rest into that truth of your essence is the pleasure of your being at the core of who you are is really under attack and threat. I was recently in a ritual where these energies came through me that was very much felt like to me the disdaining grandmothers. That's how I described them. Like the shorthand I found was the grandmothers of disdain, which has this very positive force, this force that was just frowning and they had their like chest up and out and like sort of stepping back in this look of disgust, this sort of snarl of disgust. And there were the grandmothers who said like, no more, like no further, like not on my watch. There were some patterns of collapse I was looking at and the despair of this year, you know, I think for a lot of us, and with just all the stress of all the things that have been going on and the isolation and the overwhelm during the pandemic and the other events of 2020. And they were just saying, you know, get up off the ground, get up off the floor, pick up your machete and act like you know how to use it. This is not a time when you want to be a casualty on the battlefield, that you can't afford to be a casualty and we can't afford you to be a casualty, that we need everyone working to hold that sense of their essence and hold the line against those forces, those energies, those ideologies that would seek to divorce us from our own essence, that would seek to tell us that they could tell us who we are better than we could know ourselves, or that they could meet the needs of that pain or that ache we feel through, you know, products or services that we could buy versus helping us to learn the technologies that could allow us to live connected to our essence. And there's this real sense of wanting me and others to wake up and see the level of systematic attack on those faculties that allow us to have those types of experiences and to approach, you know, life in a sense as a battlefield where those faculties are constantly being under threat, that we're not in a neutral playing field. And yet, not a battlefield in terms of metaphor of like, we are at war, we have to fight something, but more, there's this Grant Morrison quote from The Invisibles I love that says, we lied, we are not at war, this is a rescue mission. And it was sort of that sense they were guiding me toward, like, this is a rescue mission that we are on right now to rescue the technologies, to rescue our relationship and our connection, or at least the tools and the techniques that allow us to step into tending the relationship and connections that we're already all part of always, that we can't step away from even if we wanted to, but we can abuse and exploit instead of being in right relationship with, to all living things, to the archetypal realms, the conversations with the gods that are always wanting to happen as we walk through our day, to the conversations of the vast multiplicity of selves inside of us that are always wanting to happen if we let it, versus the tightly controlled version of self that we can become identified with because it allows us to be productive or just to shield ourselves from pain around us. And just for some reason, when you're talking about your experience, your essence and your work, to remember that amidst the despair just really, really reminded me of that experience I had recently, and that awareness that despair isn't just a personal issue, that it's actually, in a sense, a real result of systematic assaults on us in a certain way, or it can be. And I'm not even trying to like demonize despair or hopelessness as a bad thing, because I think to really allow us to feel those emotions can be a wonderful thing if we can then flow into the next emotion that comes out of that and let the grief we feel show us what we truly value and what is truly worth living for. But I think so often we're sort of cornered into that despair place without any tools or containers to feel the grief of that despair in a way that allows us to flow into a greater sense of who we really are and what we are here to do, which in a sense another byproduct of abandonment of ritual.
And what you're talking about is such a natural thing. I loved what you're saying, and it brought up memories of a number of different things that I encountered very early on many years ago. One, you talked about picking up the machete, and one of the earliest ritual spiritual practices that I learned was from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition of embodying the divine mind, which is the representation of like a fiery, almost demon-like entity carrying a sword in one hand and a skull cup filled with blood and wearing a necklace of severed heads. And I remember after finishing this training of learning this and embodying this practice, walking around out in the world, imagining this figure, this fiery figure of the divine mind over my head with a sword in hand, and literally severing all of the illusions that I was seeing out in the world around me that bombard us in a kind of oppressive way. And if we don't have an anchor into our essential being, our essential nature, it's just so easy to get overwhelmed by them and lost in them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I so appreciate you sharing that image of that wrathful deity. I love that image of you walking to the streets as this wrathful deity severing illusions. That's beautiful. And I think that's so important, especially, you know, for everyone right now. I think that ability to step into destruction in service of life is really important and powerful, because there's so much destruction that's not in service of life right now that I think it's easy to think of destruction as something we don't want to step into because we don't want to replicate those harms we see, and not realize that to not use our power, even our power to destroy, our capacity to kill, is to abuse our power. because all power is meant to be used to some extent, to used hopefully in service of life, but to be used, to allow the love that we are to flow through us into action, which I think might be one definition of power. And I think with that wrathful imagery and this idea of these, like, you know, illusions we need to pierce through, there's this real importance of recognizing that our process, you know, I think one thing that's really important to me in writing Deep Liberation was that it was not just going to be a self-help book about how I become more comfortable, how I, you know, deal with the pain that I'm in. That's part of it. You know, that's definitely a happy side effect of the Deep Liberation process and the book, that it will help you to form a new relationship with your trauma and with the things in your life that have caused you heartbreak and pain. But it's important to understand that the teachings that I wrote this book of, first of all, I should say, I don't consider them my teachings, that these teachings come out of a lineage that I'm part of, which was founded by Christina Pratt of the Last Mass Center for Shamanic Healing and was cultivated within the container of the Last Mass community, this community of volunteers who have gone to these teachings and have stepped up into shared leadership by council to keep the teachings in the world and to make sure the retreats are happening, you know, every year, and practicing and sharing with each other their process in this work, in the Deep Liberation work. And so these teachings that I'm talking about are not just coming through me, they're coming through my practice of these teachings over the last 10 years in community that came out of the, you know, visionary and initiatory experiences of a contemporary shaman. And what that means is that these practices are rooted not just in lineage, but in a lineage of shamanic practice. And when I use the word, you know, it's a big conversation using the word shaman and why I use the word shaman, but one aspect of how I look at the shaman, of course, outside of solely the traditional word that arises from specific peoples, when that term became applied cross-culturally by Mircea Eliade spending some of his academic capital to show the world that practitioners who were embodying this certain role that you might use the term shaman to apply to were not crazy, were not hucksters, but were actually had rich traditions of value for our human heritage to share with the world. That work that he did of that role, how I would define it, is someone who is working to tend balance between the individual and themselves and their own soul, the individual and their family, you know, and the family and their community, and the community and the spirit world and their environment, which are one and the same. There's not like some distinction between the natural world and the spirit world. It's all just the world, you know, that the community must stay in right relationship with for their survival, which is much better understood before a culture of, you know, globalization and capitalism and mass consumerism, when you actually are literally dependent on your natural resources of your local environment for your survival. Then you want to stay in balance with it, and you want to make sure that environment stays healthy, and so you can stay healthy. And so what I'm trying to say in this long, drawn-out sentence is that these practices of deep liberation are not just about personal health and well-being, but about, in a world where there is such a big gap between where we could be as humanity, where we are meant to be in a sense as humanity, as part of this living organism of the earth and right relationship with it, tending the earth and actually in service to all other life in the earth versus where we are currently. That gap is so big, we could throw, you know, thousands and millions of shamans into that gap and it wouldn't create a difference. But what I believe can create a difference is if we are willing to engage our process and not just stop at where we're comfortable, where we feel, okay, now I've resolved some of my stuff and I can do what I want to do in my life. But if we're willing to be in this process for the long haul, to engage life as a teacher, to help us to weave ourselves back into relationship with all creation, to become what some, you know, prayers would say, you know, let me be a hollow bone, to become that experience of being able to be in conversation with the archetypal realms throughout our day and let ourselves feel what the moment is calling out of us specifically in each moment, and then be able to respond effectively in real time in the moment versus just projecting onto the moment our fears and baggage from the past. I think in that way we can begin to tackle the collective issues of humanity, like systemic racism, like these deep ancestral trauma, like ways where, you know, so disconnected from our environment that we see no problem with polluting it, that can allow us to take back our role as an essential part of the organism of the world, of the earth, in a way that allows us to live a life that has heart and meaning versus just feeling, you know, sort of trapped in this endless machine, unsure if our actions really matter at all. And so that is one of my goals with this, with sharing this process and writing this book, was not just to help people feel better, but to help us cultivate the resilience, the mental, physical, emotional, spiritual resilience to be able to move into some of these core cultural wounds of our time and bring medicine to those sites of fracture, rather than waiting for our culture to be whole before we bring our medicine. Being the people who can, from within a fractured culture, be working within those fractures to mend them. And not just in that process having our own, you know, stuff be so triggered that we become paralyzed and have to turn away or get at each other's throats, as so often happens when we try to create change. And that we have the tools to create change, not just alone as rugged individuals, but in community that's sustainable, which I think is the only real way that we can create systemic change, and we're working in community versus working as an individual.
And that reminded me of what struck me when I first started reading this book of yours, was how beautifully you articulate all of this and integrate this into such a beautiful, coherent whole of understanding, and for me, of really feeling what this wholeness is. And I love so much that in addition to writing so much about the need for our own personal inner healing work, you also connect it to the responsibility we have to help shape and reshape the world that we live in, and the culture that as you described so beautifully, is so fractured and so dysfunctional and essentially insane, in that classic Native American term, Watiko.
Mm-hmm.
And you also brought up the term archetypes, and I would love for you to talk about how you and the tradition that you are working within work with archetypes, and what archetypes are and how they work with us. Because you say the archetypes are always trying to move through us and engaging through us in expressing our power into the world. And I would just love for you to flesh that out, because one of the issues that I've always had difficulty with in my life was accepting my power. I always had this sense of that there was tremendous power inside of me, but I was terrified of it. And I know that part of that terror was that I could use it in destructive and harmful ways, whether inadvertently or perhaps even deliberately in dark moments of rage and anger. But I was always terrified of that power that I could just feel was beyond the range of my comprehension even. So how do archetypes fit into all of that, and what do they mean in your tradition, and how do they work within us, and how can we work with them?
Yeah, so how I define archetypes is, and again, this is coming out of my lineage and my teachings, is as the source code of the universe. And this is actually, I find, very similar to how Jung talks about archetypes and his original definitions of them, where he's really emphasizing that these are not, like, I think people so often, I see this misquoted and misunderstood, that he explicitly says in Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious that archetypes are not gods or fairy tales or what's so often termed archetypes in a lot of, like, you know, archetypal psychology, that those are already too culturally specific and sort of culturally manufactured, that archetypes are these energies that are beyond humanity. They're not solely expressed through humanity. Whereas gods have a lot of protocol to them that comes out of the human cultures they arose in and are very culturally specific. Archetypes are these forces that move through all living things, plants, animals, humans, everything, stones even. The archetypes are always moving through. And in that way, they help us to remember how to be part of the living process that the earth is. Like most things on the earth, in a shamanic understanding, don't have what I would call free will. And free will is not about agency. I believe everything has agency, but it's more about the ability to choose to co-create reality out of alignment with your essence, with who you actually are, with the energy you came here to be. Like a tree can't come here and choose not to be a tree. Whereas a human that came here to be something, like that unique energy that is their purpose and their destiny that they chose to live in this lifetime and embody over the course of this lifetime, can choose to turn away from that destiny, can choose to not live that destiny. And so I think that's one of the things that really defines humanity as unique in creation. And so archetypes are these forces that can help us to come back into alignment with our own essence of who we are and who we came here to be in a way that is in service to all living things. So healer, for example, is an archetype that's big in this process and that I work with a lot. And especially when people are first starting out in the process, we work with healer a lot. And healer is not that energy that heals. Well, that's part of healer, sure. The energy that mends, heals, repairs. But that's kind of what's happening when, you know, the horse is already out of the barn, to speak metaphorically. Like, you've already fallen out of right relationship with healer. And then healer's coming in to help you to heal. But healer helps us to understand what we need to be in a state of health and well-being consistently. That's healer's unique medicine. And in terms of like one answer to what we need to be in a state of health and well-being is to be in the present moment, to not be stuck worrying about the past or dwelling on fears about the future, and in that way spread out across time so illness and disease can move into us. We want to be in the present moment where we have the most power to create change. And so healer is this energy that helps us to come back into that sense of being in the present moment, able to choose. And so when we've come out of right relationship with that sense of being able to fully inhabit the present moment, we can go to healer to help us. And healer can help us so we can plug into that wisdom of healer to get experiences that maybe we didn't have growing up. Maybe archetypally we're supposed to have growing up from people in our life at different developmental stages that we never got. And so it seems unfair that then we're just stuck with that for the rest of our life. So I don't think that is the case. I think we can plug back into archetypes to feel into those missing pieces of sort of encoded information that we didn't get at different developmental stages to help us come back into alignment with those big energies. And so you mentioned your struggles with power, which I certainly have had in my life. I don't know if maybe there's anyone that hasn't had some struggles with power, whether it be more in the relationship of deficiency or excess. But, you know, we're so f***ed up around power right now currently in our culture that I think it's really essential that we are working with archetypes that have a deep understanding of power. And so for me, one of those archetypes is teacher, leader, sovereign. This being that holds this essence of what it is to be in a state of wholeness and balance and trust and commitment to process without attachment to outcome. What it is to lead in a way that involves not asserting power over others or controlling others, but simply to embody your own power in a way that encourages others to step into their power. And so for me, I think a lot of my own fears around power, and a lot of them were just as you described, like innately terrifying, you know, like beyond even what could be felt in one lifetime. It had to do a lot of my maleness, actually, and the ways I had seen men in my life and in the world abusing power and not wanting to replicate that same abuse. And so in a way, I shut down a lot of my own relationship as power as a way to try to avoid doing that kind of harm. And so teacher, leader, sovereign, and also the archetype of what I call true man helped me a lot with changing my relationship with power, and also true woman. And, you know, when I use those words, true man and true woman, I'm not talking about what often gets thrown around as like the divine masculine and the divine feminine, because I believe that masculinity and femininity are social constructs, that their only usefulness is that we can deconstruct them, and then maybe reconstruct them if we choose to, again and again in new forms. But I don't believe there's any archetypal masculinity or archetypal femininity, because they're completely false cultural constructs that vary depending on what culture you're in. Whereas archetypes are these things that transcend culture and time and space. And so when I talk about true man and true woman, I'm talking about this sort of archetypal, almost biological function of the womb that contains and protects and teaches and nourishes us and is continuously willing to grow and expand around us to protect our growth and expansion and our infinite uniqueness and beauty and genius. And then true man, and of course these also might be termed true mother, true father, is this energy that pulls us out of that safety of the womb into risk and tells us, you know, it's okay to feel whatever you're feeling. You can cry, you can get upset. Even if you get hurt, it's okay, but I'm gonna be right here for you. I'll be protecting you, but you need to step into the risk. Like, you need to get back on that bike and try again. I'm right here for you. I'm not gonna make fun of you. I'm protecting you. You're safe, but you gotta try again. You gotta step into that risk because I'm here for you, supporting you in doing that. And this isn't gender-based. Like, every parent, hopefully, would be embodying true father and true mother at different times, regardless of their gender orientation. But this is about these archetypal energies that we all need as human beings in the course of our development to be in right relationship with our power. If you see power as in part the ability to bring our unique essence into expression and experience and action in the world and feel safe doing that. And so, you know, for me, I was struggling a lot with power actually when I was getting ready to write this book, and it was actually before I'd even spoken with my publisher, and I'd just been knowing there was something I needed to do that was more like a big writing project that was going to ask all of me. But I was still having so many struggles around writing that was actually part of what had even been one of my core focuses of coming into shamanic practice, of wanting to be a screenwriter, of wanting to feel my creativity like I had easy access to it, and it was just flowing, and I could be this expressive artist, and feeling so stuck and stymied with that. And, you know, our creativity is so linked to our power and our sexuality and just the essence of our divinity, in a sense, our ability to express the multiplicity of who we are in the world. And so I've been working at this for years, like for maybe 8 or 9 years at this point when this was happening. And I was like, why is it still so stuck? Why isn't it working? Why don't I have easy access to my creativity? And what happened was I decided to journey to the descendants because I felt like, okay, if I really did work through this pattern, then I wrote a book. And so there should be a book in the future that can tell me how I got through this issue. And so I went to the descendants and asked them to show me how I got through this issue. And
to find out what happened, tune in next week for the conclusion of this interview. And thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take good care of yourselves and each other. We'll go out with the trip-hop remix of The Creator Has a Master Plan from the Stolen Moments Red Hot and Cool album.
And death was. And death was. And death was.
are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification